Lecture 47, Cleopatra, the Last Ptolemy.
Welcome back. This is it, almost the end. It's where we hear about Cleopatra. Remember where we left off? Ptolemy 12, her father had died and left a will. And the will was placed in Alexandria and a copy in Rome. Rome because Rome was the power. Rome because they were the executors of the estate. He knew that there was no way that his children could rule if they didn't have the backing of Rome. Now, the will stated that two of his children will be on the throne ruling together. And this was normal Ptolemaic practice, a brother and a sister. The woman would be Cleopatra VII, his oldest daughter now. The male was going to be her younger brother. This is really a half-brother, probably. This is going to be Ptolemy XIII, a brother she detested, hated him. But let's talk a little bit about Cleopatra as a legend. Right? There's a great deal about Cleopatra that is wrong. Right? Let me just say, just wrong. And there's good reason for it. History is written by the victors. The people who win write the history. And Cleopatra lost. It's the Romans who win. And they paint a picture of Cleopatra as this femme fatale, seducing good Roman men, this beautiful temptress. She's seductive. She's promiscuous. Almost all of that is myth. It's not true. As far as we know from the records about Cleopatra, she wasn't particularly a beauty. She was monogamous. Right? She was intelligent. None of these horrible things that the Romans claim. But her life really falls into three periods. Before she meets Caesar, with Caesar, and after Caesar, which is the same as with Antony. Let's talk about before Caesar. Remember, you remember the basics, I'm sure. She was very bright, taken by her father once to Memphis where she sees the Apis bull. Perhaps that's where she gets the idea that she's going to learn an ancient Egyptian language. Very bright. Now, as a child, she watched her father. And Cleopatra knew that she would need Rome if she was going to survive. She knew that. She was bright. Very early in her reign, by the way, very early, she goes down south, for a religious ceremony. She's going to see the Bucus bull, one of the three sacred bulls. There was the Apis, the Menevis, and in the south was the Bucus bull. And she is going to see the new Bucus bull installed in the temple. And there's even a record of it, and people were amazed. The Egyptian priests were amazed. It says, and the queen got in the boat with us. You know, kind of like, she was one of us. You know, those Ptolemies didn't go south. They stayed in Alexandria. But she is, in a sense, Egyptianizing herself. She's going to be, in some ways, the most Egyptian of all Ptolemies, speaking the language, interested in the religion. She's unique. What did she look like? We don't have any certain portraits of her. There are a couple of coins. Show her with a nose that's a little bit too long. A little bit too long. There is one bust in a museum in Berlin that we're pretty sure is a portrait of Cleopatra. She probably had reddish hair. Reddish hair. She looks rather plain. Not really a femme fatale. She is not portrayed in this bust as a seductress by any means. But it's all we have of Cleopatra. Now, what happens when she is placed on the throne with her brother? The brother is younger. She's about 17. He's younger. And there is a trio that is placed as his advisors, right? This Ptolemy 13, it's a trio. There's a politician who's important. His name is Pothinus. He's a politician. There's a rhetorician, right? Somebody to make the speeches, I guess. And there's a eunuch. These three are guiding the new Ptolemy, Ptolemy 13. And the politician, Pothinus, who really is probably calling the shots, turns the people against Cleopatra. Now remember, Cleopatra's watched her father. She knows that Rome has to be courted. You know, remember how the armies are so important to everybody? Cleopatra knew that. She's going to use somebody else's army, Rome's. It's like using other people's money today. She's using other people's armies. But Pothinus turns the Greeks in Alexandria against her, saying, look, Cleopatra is pro-Roman. We're not. We're Greeks. Right? So there is a rebellion against Cleopatra. And Cleopatra is forced to flee the palace. She knows what's coming. She's going to be killed if her, you know, terrible younger brother has his way as guided by this trio. She flees to Syria, where she doesn't just go into hiding. This is a woman to be reckoned with. She raises an army in Syria. And at this point, Rome hears what's going on. Now, they are the executors of the state. Right? They've been left as executors of this estate. Rome is having its own problems, by the way. There's a civil war. The triumvirate is not getting along so well. And Pompey is going to flee to Egypt. So Pompey flees to Egypt, and Caesar is sent to straighten this all out. He's going to straighten it out. Pompey, of course, arrives first. He's fled. And is met by a delegation from Pothinus, this politician. Now, Pothinus is always trying to figure out where is the power going to be, and he says it's going to be in Caesar. So Pothinus has Pompey met, in a boat as they're coming into Alexandria Harbor. And Pompey has fled with his family, gets into a boat, and his head is cut off. Pothinus has figured out that Caesar is going to be really happy. He's going to really be in strong with Caesar when Pothinus shows up and says, I've got your opponent's head. So in front of his family, Pompey is murdered. Caesar arrives. He is furious when he is shown Pompey's head. Again, this is an honorable Roman who respects his opponents. But he's got a job at hand. He's got to establish the throne of Egypt. He wants stability because they need the grain. Rome wants the grain. Now, at this point, Cleopatra hears that Caesar is in Alexandria, in the palace. And she knows that her brother's advisors are going to be advising against her. And this is the famous scene where she figures out that she has to sneak back into the palace. And this is, if you're familiar with the Elizabeth Taylor movie, this is where she comes in the rug, wrapped up in a rug. It's interesting, by the way, it shows how much older I'm getting. When I now make references to the movie and refer to Cleopatra as Elizabeth Taylor, usually my students don't know who she is. They don't know the movie. I'm at the point now where there's a whole generation that has grown up not knowing this wonderful movie. It's historically quite accurate, quite accurate. But anyway, she does, as far as we know, get smuggled into the palace in a rug. And Caesar says, what is this? It's a gift, right? And then unrolls it, and sure enough, it's this 17-year-old girl. Now, what is this relationship between Caesar and Cleopatra? First of all, Caesar is a middle-aged man. He's been around. He's cultured, by the way. You know, I wonder, often, what language did they speak in? Cleopatra spoke many languages. Many, might have spoken Latin, right? Caesar certainly would have spoken Greek. So they can talk. There's no problem about that. They don't need interpreters. And you certainly don't need interpreters for what they were going to do later. But he has never seen a woman like Cleopatra. Roman women were kept in the houses, uneducated. They weren't educated. Greek women were educated. Cleopatra, think about it. You know, she knows the languages. She has been to the library at Alexandria, read Herodotus. She is educated. She is a powerful woman. She is a force. He's never seen a woman like this. This is very different. She may be 17 years old, but this is a very different kind of woman, say, then Caesar's wife. He has a wife, of course, back in Rome. Anyway, Caesar's decision is that both she and Ptolemy 13, her bratty younger brother, should rule together. Pothinus is sort of against this, and he thinks he can have an insurrection against Caesar's small force there, and they're causing trouble for Caesar. And there's a small war. It's called the Alexandrian Wars. Small, very small. It's not a real full-scale war. But in the end, of course, Caesar wins. Cleopatra has Pothinus executed. Right? Her bratty younger brother, Ptolemy the 13, tries to escape and drowns in the river. Right? Cleopatra is alone on the throne, just what she wanted. Now, tradition required that she have a male at her side, and she marries the even younger brother, who becomes Ptolemy 14, who's a non-entity. And when I say a non-entity, he disappears. We don't know what happened to him, maybe. I mean, Cleopatra is indeed a Ptolemy. Perhaps she had him killed. We don't know what happens to Ptolemy 14, but he certainly disappears in history. But Cleopatra is now the mistress of Caesar. And we have some records of what happens to them. She takes them on a boat trip south. They are going to go through Egypt. Now, I think this is a really calculated, smart move. Granted, Caesar is sophisticated, educated, but he's never seen a place like Egypt. He's come from Rome. He's never seen a palace like the one in Alexandria. And other things. I'm thinking about when we go to Egypt. He's never seen the pyramids. He's never seen any of these things. And she's going to show it all to him. She knows he's going to be impressed. So they go on this boat, the Thalamegos, the big boat it's called. It was a huge boat, practically, a floating house. And what would they have seen? Pyramids. Would have probably been Caesar's first view of a mummy. Kind of interesting, his first taste of maybe immortality, that you could be immortal, perhaps. They go south, he sees Thebes. And they go far, even further. They go all the way to Aswan. Quite a trip. Now, as they're going through Egypt, the people are seeing their queen. Something they hardly ever saw with the other Ptolemies, their king or queen. And they are treating Caesar as her consort. She is, of course, in Egyptian politics, religion, a goddess. And Caesar is kind of being treated like a god alongside of her. And I think he probably liked it. This is where Caesar maybe gets the idea that he's a little bit above mere mortals. It'll cost him his life, but we'll see. Anyway, they visit a place called Hermonthis, modern Armont. By this time, Cleopatra is pregnant with Caesar's child. And they agree that if it's a boy, they will build a birth house there, a little shrine to commemorate the birth of a god, because Cleopatra is a goddess and her son is going to be a god. And indeed, it is a boy, named, politically clever, Caesarion, Little Caesar. And the birth house is built, and to this day, by the way, if you want to find traces of Cleopatra in Egypt, it's very hard because the Romans, of course, destroy it. But if you go to Hermonthis, Armont, there are the remains of the birth house. It's been destroyed almost completely. There's one block, it's upside down, and it has Cleopatra's cartouche on it. Right? It's the last, one of the last places you can see evidence of Cleopatra. But Caesarion, it's a boy. Now, Caesar has to go back to Rome. There's business. Right? He's a member of the triumvirate. And there's civil war going on. But after a while, he sends for Cleopatra and Caesarion. Now, this is, in a sense, legitimizing them as husband, wife. And remember I said that she's really monogamous? As far as we know, this is the only lover slash husband she's ever had up until this point. Right? And by Egyptian standards, he certainly would have been viewed as a husband. Certainly by Egyptian standards. Not by Roman, of course. By Roman, he's got his wife. A Roman wife. A good Roman wife. But he sends for Cleopatra, which must have been, in some sense, an outrage. But in some sense, Rome had never seen anything like Cleopatra when she shows up with her entourage. And Caesar establishes her in his villa outside of Rome. So Caesarion, his son, Cleopatra, are established in Caesar's villa outside of Rome. During this time, Caesar celebrated a triumph. When troops came back, when Roman troops came back, they paraded the booty that they had brought with them. And he celebrates an Egyptian triumph. Now remember, he has won the Alexandrian Wars against Ptolemy XIII and Pothinus. And it's a kind of exotic affair. Rather exotic. A giraffe is paraded. Right? Interesting, the first giraffe ever seen in Rome. And as a matter of fact, we have an eyewitness account of it. They call it a camel leopard because it's got spots like a leopard, but kind of looks like a camel. It's a camel leopard is what they call it. And there's another kind of featured attraction in this triumph. Remember Cleopatra's younger sister, Arsinoe? Right? Well, she is a real Ptolemy and had plotted against her sister, plotted against Cleopatra. Caesar, as part of the triumph, has her paraded in chains in Rome. Arsinoe is in chains. Now, Cleopatra must have had mixed feelings about this. She didn't like her sister. Don't even think that for a minute. Hated her. But here is a Greek being paraded in Rome. Right? It's a mixed feeling that she must have had when she saw that. Remember, you know, we've talked about the Ptolemies, and we've done them fairly quickly. But we're looking back on a heritage of 300 years of Ptolemies ruling Egypt. Cleopatra has this heritage and she is proud. But her sister is displayed. Now, Caesar also has a statue of Cleopatra as Isis erected in a Roman temple. Rome is outraged. To have an Egyptian presented as a goddess in a Roman temple is really pushing it. Plus, he's got a good Roman wife. Not only that, though, Caesar is getting the feeling that he's very special, right? He's been consort of a goddess. And the Roman Senate is worried that he's going to want to rule as a king. And this is when the famous Ides of March occurs, when it is prophesied that Caesar shouldn't go to the Senate because it's the Ides of March and he will be done in. And indeed, Caesar is stabbed to death on the steps of the Senate because he was becoming too Egyptian slash Greek. They were afraid that he was going to go beyond a republic. Right? Now, this leaves Cleopatra in a very, very difficult situation. Very difficult. She's in Rome, which in some sense is clearly hostile. Clearly hostile. The women probably were really interested, you know, in the makeup and those kind of things. They were really interested in her. But not the politicians. She has to flee. She's got young Caesarion. She's got to flee. And she flees back to Egypt. I think it's at this point where Cleopatra had to have thought that she is Isis. It's just like Isis. She's a goddess. Even dressed as Isis for certain religious festivals. She is widowed. Her husband has been killed violently. And she has an infant son that she has to protect. So as she's fleeing back to Egypt, she is Isis. Quite interesting. She flees and returns to Egypt and has herself carved on the back wall of Dendera Temple, as Isis Hathor. Hathor was often confused with Isis, and her consort there is Caesarion, her young son. Caesarion's the god. Forget about Ptolemy 14 is gone, disappeared. It's Caesarion who's going to rule. Right? Well, we're about ready for the last phase of Cleopatra's life with Mark Antony. Caesar's will did not leave Caesarion as his heir. He was a Roman. He just couldn't do it, it seems. Nephew Octavian is left as the heir. And there is a real feud between Octavian and Mark Antony for power. And Antony realizes if he's going to win, he needs the wealth of Egypt. It's always back to Egypt and their grain. Always. So he asks Cleopatra to meet him at Tarsus in Turkey. And Cleopatra is in no hurry. She kind of views him as an upstart Roman. She is a goddess. She comes in her own sweet time in an incredible boat. We have descriptions of it, you know, of oarsmen dressed as gods and little angels all over the thing, and it was like a house floating. I mean, incredible thing with tents, gold furniture, gold dishes, thrones. And she shows up at Tarsus, right? Now, understand, Antony has never seen really anything quite like this. You know, he had his brief visit to Alexandria before, but this is incredible. And she invites him on the boat for a banquet. And this is where the stuff of which legends are made happens. They have gold dinnerware, right? Plates of gold. And she's calculating what she's doing. She knows what she's doing. And fantastic furniture. And at the banquet, she's wearing these incredible pearl earrings. And the famous story is that, you know, they're noticeable. They're big. Takes off an earring, drops it in wine, you know, which is partly vinegar, dissolving it and drinks her pearl. Right? That's the story. Maybe it happened, maybe it didn't, but it's a great story. But there's no question but that after this party, Antony is really impressed. I mean, she gives the guests gold dishes to take home as kind of like party favors. You know, oh, you like the furniture? Take it home. It's nothing, right? It's calculated to impress this Antony. Antony is not Caesar. Antony is a little bit cruder, not so educated, kind of lusty. And it's interesting because Cleopatra can live this kind of life too. They go back to Egypt, right? And they kind of form a drinking party, a kind of small club, right? They call themselves the Inimitable Livers, right? They're really high livers, high rollers. And they've got their friends, and they go drinking. And she participates in this. She's kind of able to live these two lives of the goddess and also sort of consort of or wife of this army man. But things are going to change. Cleopatra becomes pregnant and gives birth to twins. Now, she's with Antony. Remember when she was with Caesar? The son is named Caesarion. She has twins. She's not going to name him after Antony. No. It's a boy and a girl. Alexander Helios. Alexander the sun. Cleopatra Selene. Cleopatra the moon. Right? She's going back to her real heritage. The one that she loves to think about. Alexander the Great. That's her dream of being like Alexander the Great. Not even like her father. She must have loved but knew he was a loser. You know? Not like the other Ptolemies. Not like Physicon, Thaddeus. Not like none of them. She's going back to Alexander the Great, and her kids are named Alexander Helios and Cleopatra Selene. But Antony has to go back to Rome. And what does he do? He marries Octavia. Octavia is the sister of Octavian. It's a political marriage. It's a political marriage. But think how Cleopatra must have felt. Totally abandoned. She's now got three kids, right? She's got Caesarion. She's got Alexander, she's got Cleopatra, and the person she thought of as a husband certainly has abandoned her. Well, don't feel sorry for her. She's still queen of Egypt. She's got a lot of power. She's not out of the ballgame. She's abandoned for 3 years. And what happens? Antony is starting his wars. He needs to raise money for the army. He needs Cleopatra. He contacts her. And he says, I need to talk to you. Now, Cleopatra agrees to meet Antony in Syria. He agrees to it. Right? She's going to do it. And he's going to do it. They're going to both have a meeting. But she is thinking ahead. She's been abandoned. She's no fool. She works out an agreement. They finally meet. And there is like a prenuptial agreement. I mean, it's the kind of thing that any Hollywood lawyer would have been proud of. She is smart. Antony agrees to marry Cleopatra. After the wars are over, that Cleopatra is going to finance, Cleopatra will get Sinai, Judah, Cyprus, Arabia, right? Not only that, he's going to marry her, but Caesarion's going to be the pharaoh. Right? Gives away his title of ruling Egypt. And another kid is born now. Right? She's got another child on the way. It's a boy. She's not going to name it Antony. It's Ptolemy. Another Ptolemy, going back to her heritage. Probably thinking maybe of her father, but maybe of Ptolemy 1 and 2. Of the library and the lighthouse and her tradition. So she's got four kids now. Right? And Antony goes to war and they go poorly. The wars go poorly. Cleopatra is working in there helping. She brings troops. She brings relief. Right? Interestingly, Octavia, Antony's wife, also tries to come with help from Rome. She's sort of being the virtuous wife. Oh, I'm deserted, but I will help. Antony sends her back. Octavia sent back to Rome. It's a victory for Cleopatra. She's won over Octavia. Then there's some minor triumphs. There's, in Alexandria, they celebrate the Armenian triumph. It's a minor victory, but there's a parade, and at least they've got something to celebrate. And there, Cleopatra's dressed as Isis on a sort of a platform. The children are all dressed up as various countries' heads of states. And Antony proclaims Cleopatra as queen of all the territories he said he was going to give her. Caesarion is called king of kings. He's going to be her co-regent. Alexander Helios, one of the twins, he's given Armenia and Pontia, the Pontus, right? Cleopatra Selene gets Libya. And little Ptolemy, he gets Phoenicia in northern Syria. So these kids are really getting endowments. You know, they're not going to have to worry about going to college. Cleopatra has worked it out. She has made the deal. And she is controlling Antony. At this point, Rome fears Cleopatra. Fears her. She is taking their Antony, who should be giving Rome the spoils of war, and he's giving it to Egypt. Right? There is going to be a war that's going to end it all. Octavian declares war. Not on Antony. He's a Roman. But on Cleopatra, the Greek, the Egyptian. And this is where all the bad press starts about Cleopatra, the seductress. Well, the Battle of Actium is fought. That's the crucial battle. It's fought at sea. And it goes poorly. It goes very poorly. Cleopatra is on a ship. She's in the middle of the battle. Imagine that. She has her own ship in a battle, not leaving Antony alone for a minute. And she has to flee. They pick up their sails. She goes back to Egypt. Antony follows, right? But he's sulking. Cleopatra's planning. Antony is sulking. In the end, Octavian marches on Alexandria. It's the end. Offers Cleopatra a truce. Give me Antony. She refuses. Right? They march. It really is the end. Now, Cleopatra will not be captive. She will not be taken captive. She has seen her sister in chains, and it won't happen to her. She starts planning poison. Right? She's planning. She knows she's going to kill herself, and she sends a message to Antony saying, I'm dead. She has barricaded herself in the palace. Antony, believing that she is dead, runs himself in on his sword. Doesn't quite kill himself immediately. Doesn't die immediately. Then Cleopatra, right, hears about what happened to Antony, and he's brought to Cleopatra, dying, right, and dies there. He dies in her practical arms. And then Octavian, who wants to take Cleopatra back to Rome, parade her is fooled. She has, we believe it's snakes, smuggled in a basket of figs, and she dies with her handmaidens next to her, Iris and Charmian. Octavian is outraged, because he's been cheated of parading Cleopatra in Rome. But it's the end. Cleopatra is the last great ruler of Egypt. It's the end of the Egyptian civilization and the end of an incredible story. But next time, I'll try to summarize a bit and put it all in perspective. I'll see you then.